The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program here on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM in the studios on the campus of Georgia Tech. Inside the Black Box, science only funnier. I'm your host, Pete Ludovis, here with my ever-effervescent co-host, Bill Hunt, a man who every time he orders a deli sub insists on a little bit of 5% by volume aqueous solution of acetic acid. Bill, how you doing?
I don't even know. What is that, the oil and vinegar? Is that what that is?
That would be the vinegar.
I do have the oil and vinegar.
Do you do? I just guess. On the Subway sandwich. You look like a mayonnaise kind of guy. That's what
I am. You know, but that's great that you noticed.
You know, I'm trying to do some goofy scientific joke every time we open, and it's getting tough.
You never cease to amaze me. I don't even recognize that guy you announced.
Recognize? Bill Hunt. We're inventing new words here.
That was in Winnie the Pooh.
Ladies and gentlemen.
It's a Pooh-centric world.
I think that's about the level that our show typically is at, Winnie the Pooh and the 100-acre wood.
Right.
All right, so the title of today's show, ladies and gentlemen, is Control Freaks of Science and Engineering. We'll be talking about control theory and the fact that almost everything has some sort of digital control, right? Everything from your washing machine to your toaster oven and
not necessarily digital.
Not necessarily digital, right? And we probably will talk a little about analog control today.
Right.
And our guest today is Professor Martha Grover Gallivan, Assistant Professor of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering here at Georgia Tech. She received her bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, correct? At the University of Illinois. Her master's degree and PhD at the California Institute of Technology, and she works here in the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. Her research brings together the fields of process control and materials processing. Of particular interest to her are systems in which the dynamics require explicit consideration of discrete atomic interactions. The overall goal is to optimize material properties by computing nominal processing conditions and designing feedback control strategies using a mathematical representation of the relevant physics.
Dang.
Martha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm Martha. I'm a control freak. It's very nice to be here today.
Are you really a control freak?
No.
Oh, okay. And actually, we've got somebody new joining our staff today. Trent is running the big board for us.
And
I'm not getting squat out of my headphones. Can you hear anything?
I can hear
things. We're actually on the air, so I'm just going to pretend.
Yeah, just switch them.
So I'm using the headphones that don't work.
Turn it to 11.
All right, turn it to
11.
Not 10.
Not 10,
but 11.
11.
And that would be what was the name of that movie?
Spinal Tap.
Okay. Yes. Okay. We obviously have the right guy running the running board for us today. Now, your major here at Georgia Tech is
discrete mathematics.
Discrete mathematics, and that do the girls really dig that sort of thing? Or?
Better than being indiscreet about the mathematics.
Now, I have to watch myself today because our guest Martha Gallivan is on a crusade to change the Georgia Tech. Oh, can I bring this up? She's giving me the funny look.
I didn't know she was on a crusade.
I agree with her, too. You realize our fight song is very sexist.
I'm just trying to understand the various opinions on the subject.
Well, then,
this is a controversial issue. That's what I've learned so far in the last 2 days I've been asking about this.
Is it controversial?
Apparently. Maybe we'll get some calls in on this.
What's sexist about the fight song? I'm usually drinking whiskey during the middle of that.
Well, that's part of the song. Apparently all men in the fight song drink whiskey and say to hell with Georgia.
Well, I'd just like to point out, actually, that I like to drink whiskey straight, and so I just would like to be included in that also.
Okay. You don't want to be dressed up in blue and gold and sent to Georgia Tech to cheer the brave and bold. It sounds like only women are cheerleaders here.
Well, but the fact of the matter was, when the fight song was written, it was an all-male institution, and they haven't updated the fight song since then.
That's really all I'm saying. Yeah. Modern sensibilities and that sort of thing.
And it could be updated, but yeah, I mean, it was written. It'd be like Florida State using a fight song from when it was a women's teachers' college.
That would be interesting.
I think that's a great idea.
I'm not making this stuff up. You know,
it is true that women didn't have the right to vote at the time the song was adopted.
That's not true. Come on, I don't know, when was the fight song written?
I don't know.
1905.
1905. So they didn't have the right to vote. Oh, those were days. Those were the days.
Whereas now, Bill should not have the right to vote, but he still does.
Yeah.
The students have changed a little bit. Instead of putting your daughter on campus to cheer the brave and bold, they have it to raise the ratio. So they always yell that out every time.
That's true. And the ratio is high now. In chemistry, we're at or slightly more than 50% typically. And in chemical engineering, we're between 35 and 45%, depending on the particular year. So
we're pretty down there in electrical engineering.
You are bad.
We are bad.
And I think it's due to your presence alone, Bill,
yeah, I know.
Actually.
I'm just saying, you know, for you guys out there, if you're wanting to pick up a chick, don't go to an IEEE workshop anywhere.
So the opposite is actually true if you're a woman and you're in a field like control theory.
Uh-huh.
The odds are pretty good.
The odds are really good.
The odds are good, but what about the goods, Martha?
The goods are odd.
I love that joke.
Yeah, that's true.
And you were the first person to tell me that.
Yeah.
So you told me that about people at Caltech. But comedians do that as well, right?
True.
Because there are a lot of men in comedy as well, and mm-hmm. trust me, they believe the goods are out as well. Mm-hmm. So now that we've jumped right into the controversy of our horribly sexist fight song.
In comedy, the goods are odd and they're unemployed, but go ahead.
Well, they're employed, they just don't make that much money. Since we've jumped into the fray here, perhaps we could remind our listeners what our call-in number is, because we will be taking calls during the second half of the hour.
All right, it's 404-894-2468.
There you have it. And, of course, if you're listening to us on WREK.org, it's on the website as well. I just don't have it in front of me. That's why I'm going to Trent to remind us of that number. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll begin, as we often do, with science in the news. Bill, you've got updates on the Mars lander.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a little bit dated, but it landed over Memorial Day weekend, and it landed on the polar ice cap. So NASA is, their slogan is, follow the water.
Right,
so
we're looking for water
like
this time.
Intergalactic divining rod trying to find water. You know, I didn't know the drought in Atlanta had gotten so bad we were going to Mars. But they're going to scoop down, not really drill down, and see if they can see signs of life and how much water there is and all that. They've now currently got an electrical glitch, which is not an acronym for anything.
Ooh, that was a communication problem. But
yeah.
My understanding is over the weekend they did fix that.
Oh, they did? Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So the arm was stuck, you know, which nobody wants that.
Oh, no, that's a different glitch. Mm-hmm. This was a communication problem with
the
UHF antenna.
This is its glitch. And I've recently discovered there's a faculty member in aerospace engineering here who's very heavily involved in this, so we'll try to get him on the program, Bob Brown.
Okay, so... Mm-hmm. Well, here's an interesting point. We're talking about control theory. Is mm-hmm. this a good example of how control can help?
I think it would be an
excellent...
I'm
not asking you. I'm asking our guest, Martha.
Well, presumably the problem isn't actually the control theory. It's the implementation. probably it's not because it's a bad controller, although that's possible. It's probably because one of the sensors isn't working, or else the computer went down. Or
it could just be a materials problem and the hinge got stuck.
That would be an actuator problem in our fancy speak.
There you go.
Yeah,
actuator.
Right. Yeah.
The thing that moves or does something, right?
It acts.
But all that has to be...
I like that which acts.
I would suspect, not being in that area, that a lot of advances got made in the controls area during the space program. Because they were... Is that true?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And even earlier than that in aircraft, that a lot of control was developed in the context of aircraft and space mm-hmm. system as well.
Right.
So I'm sure that's true, Bill, but I think a lot of actuator and control theory advancements occurred due to the animatronics at Disneyland.
Particularly the Hall of Presidents, actually. That was after that. Yeah, when are we going to stick George W. in there?
No, it's so good that actually when you go to the Hall of Presidents, George W. Bush actually looks like a president when he's there. It's amazingly good. There it is. The first cheap political shot. Oh, come on. That's a standard
joke. That's good.
No,
that's good. I like
and,
that.
You know, I could make similar jokes about Clinton, but the FCC would not allow it.
No,
okay.
They don't have that in the Hall of Presidents.
All right, so I want to point out an article that was actually in the Science Times from this week on May 27th mm-hmm. in the New York Times by Natalie Angier, entitled Curriculum Designed to Unite Art and Science. They point out it's been some 50 years since the physicist turned novelist C.P. Snow delivered the famous Two Cultures lecture at the University of Cambridge, in which he decried the gulf of mutual incomprehension, the hostility and dislike that divided the world's natural scientists, its chemists, engineers, physicists, and biologists, from its literary intellectuals, a group that, by Snow's reckoning, included pretty much everyone who wasn't a scientist. And it actually points out that a lot of people are doing interesting things to merge these two curriculum. And I, for one, think it's a good mm-hmm. idea. And I saw it firsthand when I actually spoke at North Springs High School about a month mm-hmm. ago. We had a number of the Science Fair winners on the show about a couple months ago. And I think, and Martha was talking to me about this before the show, that the whole idea of design, design of a control system, design of anything, design of a hypothesis, before it's a hypothesis where you can systematically analyze it using the scientific method, which we talked about 2 weeks ago, it's a gut feeling. It's very creative. I don't think it's too much different than the composer, the writer, that sort of thing. What do you think? I mean, you are a musician.
Yeah, I these are all constrained problems. So if you're actually trying to design a circuit that's going to work, you can't just do anything and have it still work. But, you know, one of the things in related to controls in the analog integrated circuit industry is just weird circuit structures in those integrated circuits allow to compensate for temperature. So it would be feedback such that over temperature the performance is exactly the same. But it's a constrained problem, and art is a constrained problem. Unconstrained art is not good. I think I can say the FCC will let me say not good. I think I can say not good.
Modern art. I mean,
well, but again, some of it is not good, which I'm not sure the initials for not good actually are.
But
I mean, constrained art in a context that makes sense is marvelous, but unconstrained art that's not constrained or not subject to constraints doesn't work.
Right. So you're actually talking about the similarity between science and technology and art.
There's a set of rules. You can break some of them. You can stretch them a little bit, but you know they're going to come back to bite you if you don't follow them.
So. Good point. Good point.
That's what. That's why you pay me so much to be on the show
exactly.
with you.
So that's why I think schools like North Springs here in Sandy Springs, just outside Atlanta, are so interesting because it's a magnet school not only in science and math but also in art.
Yeah, I think it's
I think
great
that's
thing.
A good thing. I think a lot of our maybe you guys can talk about the classes you teach, but I think we are beating the creativity out of our undergraduates.
That's what I like to think.
Trent's got this glazed look over his face like, yeah, you're doing it's horrible. Is that true?
I don't know. I don't really go to class.
He rarely goes to class.
Just read some books, go listen to the professors when they do talks. Works out pretty well.
Okay. Well, so we're boring in class. That's what
He's optimizing his minimizing overlap functions with class and faculty.
All right, so we should at least start talking about control.
I think that'd be a good idea.
We can take a quick break first.
Okay, are we at a quarter after? Okay, then my watch is obviously so. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break.
Man.
You're listening to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. We'll be right back after this.
Every Wednesday evening at 9 o'clock, tune your radio to WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM for Destroy All Music, a program that plays something for everyone. That's Destroy All Music, each and every Wednesday night at 9 o'clock, here on the home of Quality Diverse Radio, WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM. Turn it up.
Get your weekly funk fix at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. The Electric Boogaloo throws it down every Thursday from 11 to midnight. Phalanx, L-Dog, and Treacherous are your funk doctors emeritus, and they'll even feature a guest lecture every now and then from the finest professors in groovology. You can hear all the funky grooves from the 60s, 70s, and even through today. That's the Electric Boogaloo each and every Thursday night at 11, right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where our guest, Martha Gallivan, is talking to us about control. So, and not control like, you know, the way my wife dominates my life. Control how you make systems and processes work. So what exactly is control, Martha?
Well, control is pretty much what it sounds like. So it probably is the same thing as your wife controlling you.
Rats.
It's pretty much just making something do what you want it to do. That's all control is.
You are correct. That is what my wife's goal is. So, all right.
Yeah. So, you know, first you have to figure out what it is that you want it to do. Then you have to figure out what you can measure to figure out what's actually going on. So you got to figure out where it is and then decide where you want it to be and then compare those two things. So, and then you do something to change it.
So those are basically the three different parts of a control scheme.
So you have to measure something and you have to have some way of changing something. So you're not very effective at control if you can't actually influence a system.
Okay.
And then you have to have your rules that determine how you take what you measure and how you determine how it is you're actually going to act on the system.
So for example, if I'm trying to think of one, I'm going to get out of my depth quickly because I don't know anything
about
cars.
Obviously, not enough caffeine this morning, Bill.
Well, that's why this is, there's a catfish swimming here that you can't see. That's how strong this stuff is. This iced tea, that is. So if your car had absolutely no control system in it, it probably didn't initially, you would step on the gas, increase gas to the carburetor, right? And if there's no control, that how would that system work?
Carburetor, what kind of car are you driving, dude?
Okay, man, all right, geez.
There are a lot of levels of control in a car. So the kind of high level of control in a car is you. When you're driving the car. Mm-hmm. So you look outside and then you decide, I'm going to turn the steering wheel or I'm going to push the brake or the gas.
You mean you metaphorically, not Bill, because he can barely keep it in the lanes. I'm not sure he's a good example.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
I have never, ever, ever had an accident.
Really? Never?
Period.
Never that the authorities know about or never?
Never.
I'm impressed.
I'm the engineer that worries and sees trouble coming 20 miles away.
He's a planner.
Planner. But anyway, so I was trying to think of a good example.
Yeah,
where you, I guess I'm thinking of, you know, there's sort of the fire and forget. You give it a command and it goes off and without any control, it doesn't necessarily do what you told it to do because you're not feeding back that it's not quite there. It's, you know, you don't have, some control to make sure that it gets back where you really want it to go.
So you're kind of the high level controller, but then there's computer controllers in modern cars that are built in to regulate the different parts of the car,
right, like the camshaft speed, for example.
Yeah,
in my
you've got a computer
car.
Chip in there, you know, and then the computer breaks, and then the car doesn't work, and that's annoying. And
they charge me $800 to replace the camshaft speed controller.
He's whining again.
I am whining because my car's in the shop yet again. But you were talking about the different sort of control speak things before, and we delineated the three different parts. So you're talking about measurement. Is that the sensor part? Is that what control
is? Sensor, Sensor is a measurement.
So in my wife's control scheme, measurement would be looking to see if I've left my socks on the floor again, right? That's what she senses.
That's right.
Then there's this rule or law.
She probably doesn't
law.
Even have to measure that.
Well, she does.
That's
sensor.
So highly predictable.
Yeah, well, this is a good point. If there's no uncertainty going on, if you know exactly what things are going to do, you don't need to measure anything because you already know. But life is unpredictable, so you can never really use open loop control, meaning
okay,
no measurements.
So that's
you really
what
need the feedback
means,
of the
right.
measurement.
You
yeah,
don't measure
you gotta
it.
Use...
You just do the same thing each time because so she will just go in. Look at my socks, yell at me. She doesn't have to look at the socks because it is open loop control. I always leave my socks on the floor.
But she probably looks because, you know, maybe one day the dog ate him or something.
Okay. So that would be closed loop control where you actually have measurement, you have a law, and then based on what that law tells you to do with the measurement, you do what? You actuate, you act, right? That's the actuator you mentioned.
Well, first she has to think about it before she can act, right? She has to decide what she's going to do.
Okay.
And then she can act.
And that's the scary part.
That's the control law. It's her thinking. Your brain. Okay. Your brain is a control. Is your own control law.
So if she like needs something from me, like household repairs, she'll be nicer and won't yell at me quite as much as she normally would.
That's exactly right.
I'm sorry.
This is control.
All right, there you go. There it is. Control in your everyday life.
Well, here's one I've been thinking about. So, part of this Center for Music Technology at Georgia Tech, and it looks like I'm going to be able to get a router for making guitar soundboards and piano soundboards and this kind of thing. And you can either get a system that will this strictly feed forward. You give it, you tell it what to cut out based on a computer program, and but it has no feedback on where is it, did it really make the size cut that you're talking about or not. Or you can pay more money and get the servo control. So one is just a stepper motor where it says go off and, you know, turn the router at this speed for this length of time and move this position. But if the wood is denser than you thought it was going to be, then you're not going to necessarily dig as deep in that length of time as you thought. So you've got to have a servo in there, a control system to get you exactly precisely where you, what you wanted, mm-hmm. as opposed to just the command, here's how much you need to cut. So that's the one I've been more thinking right. about lately.
So let's take a simple example. So, mm-hmm. Martha, what's a simple example of control?
Well, I think a really good example is taking a shower. Taking a shower is a good example.
Right, so, which is something Bill's very unfamiliar
like
with.
Once a week, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Well, so there's a feedback there. You know, you have to decide if you think you smell. And then sometimes you get feedback from other sources, like Pete says.
Yeah,
his wife
absolutely.
Says, you know, Pete, you smell, you need to go take a shower.
Right, she's very unabashed about that, too.
But let's say you decide you're going to take a shower. So you make a decision, right? So in my shower upstairs, it's pretty far from the water heater.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a long time to heat up. And so, you know, if I just turn it on full blast to hot and I get in and I wait, all of a sudden it's going to be really hot. So if I'm not too smart, then I'm just going to make it be really cold. And then it'll take a while, so I'll just burn myself for a while, right? Mm-hmm. And then eventually it'll get cold. And then I'll say, oh, no. And then I'll turn it all the way hot again. Mm-hmm. So the point is, if you overreact, if your controller is too aggressive, then it's just going to be unstable and you're not going to get the kind of performance you want. So you have to think about how you're going to respond and not under-respond, not over-respond.
So one thing might be there
system.
Is that if you had a system that was trying to control the temperature of the water to 1/100th of a degree, that's horribly expensive. But if you're taking a shower, it just needs to be within a couple of degrees, maybe. So there's the precision, right, of the control.
Yeah, that's true, too. So what you need out of your controller depends on what your kind of outcome, what kind of outcome mm-hmm. you want, what kind of how specific you want it to be.
Right.
Yeah,
whereas
right.
there might be some chemical engineering application where you need real tight control on temperature of water in the semiconductor industry or deionized water, whatever it is, you might need really tight temperature control, whereas other things you don't. And there's a cost, right, of trying to get more precision than you actually need.
Well, yeah, and a lot of that would come into sensor cost and potentially mm-hmm. also the actuator cost, how you adjust the valves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in when someone's taking a shower, then it's your own sensor, right? We can mm-hmm. sense temperature. But if you wanted to do something very precise in some chemical process, then mm-hmm. you'd have to buy a very sensitive temperature sensor, right? So that would be more expensive.
So let's talk about another term in control jargon, disturbance, right? So this is when I'm taking a shower and my 8-year-old will like flush the toilet in the next bathroom, right?
Which is he doing this on purpose to annoy you or just randomly?
Sometimes I think he is.
I know his son and his interactions with Pete. Yes, he's doing it on purpose.
I think he is because when he just says it normally, he often forgets to flush the toilet to end of embarrassment in my
household.
He
laughs when Pete gets scalded.
But
it's a great game at their house.
Yeah, so then of course.
Good times.
Yeah.
So that's a disturbance. So how do control schemes deal with disturbances? Is that something control schemes are designed to do?
Yeah, definitely. So a disturbance is something that, you know, you did know ahead of time. This is exactly why we need control. And so a disturbance could be something that actually, you know, acts and affects a system like Dylan flushing the toilet. Or it could just be uncertainty, like you thought that it takes this long for the pipe to heat up, but really it takes a shorter or longer amount of time or something. So they're all different places that uncertainty can come in. And so a disturbance is usually somebody actually making an action. So if you don't know anything about the disturbance, ahead of time, then you'll only get an indication of it when you start, when your measurements start to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes what you're measuring isn't exactly the disturbance. And so a big part of control theory, or an important area in control theory, is dealing with something we call observability, which, just like control, is exactly what it sounds like.
It's, I like that.
Can
That's
you
good.
Observe what's going on about what you're really interested in based on what you measure? And so in this case, it might be hard to tell for a while exactly what happened, or maybe you know something happened because you're burning, but you don't know exactly what it was.
So would a,
you don't know which toilet was flushed, for example.
Right. So so it could have been his wife.
It could have been, yeah.
Flushing the toilet to get him scalded. So is observability also, like, you've got sensors for temperature, fluid flow, something like that, but what you really need, can you observe some outcome that's not one of those?
That's right. So usually you have a certain number of quantities that you use when you're putting together a model of the system. So one thing we haven't talked about with control is that it's fairly mathematical discipline, and it's usually based on writing down some sort of mathematical model of your shower and toilet plumbing system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the different quantities that you need to use in your model, they're called states. And then you have measurements. And sometimes you can directly measure some or all of your states. Sometimes you measure things that are related to your states, but not exactly those states. So, for example, you might have some state, like the flow rate or something, that you're not actually measuring. You're just measuring the temperature of the shower when it comes out.
Oh, right. And you're sort
with
of
your body.
Presuming what all the other variables are based on that.
Yeah, it's kind of like detective work. You got to kind of work back and see if you can figure out what happened. But you want to do this all real fast automatically. So that's what your computer algorithm helps you do.
So let's,
but it's detective work.
In terms of
fast detective work.
Plastics or polymers, and you're making those. So if you're, I'm like trying to make up something sensible out of something I don't know nothing about. But if you're trying to make Gore-Tex, a fabric, water-resistant fabric, you know, temperature and some other stuff doesn't obviously directly relate to whether or not you really got the hydrophobic.
Yeah.
So you're not necessarily measuring hydrophobicity,
right?
And this
is a big problem in using control materials processing. So that's what my research program is about. That's what I'm interested in doing. And so it is a big challenge, is that you can measure some things, but you usually don't measure exactly what it is that you want to control.
Right. So the end result is a Gore-Tex, you know, is Gore-Tex still a material? Am I dating myself again?
Yeah, it's mechanically degraded.
I think Spandex is back.
Spandex
wears that a lot, actually.
Spandex was never appropriate. But anyway, not for me anyway. But she threw me off.
Your example is a good one. Let's take a simpler product.
Gore-Tex, I mean, you want it to not soak up water.
Well, let's just take polyethylene, right? When you make polyethylene, the readouts on your controllers for big companies that do this, they look at the pressure of the ethylene, and they look at the temperature and the heat output.
Now, is
like
that what Gore-Tex is? Or?
No, that's polytetrafluoroethylene. It's Teflon.
Okay.
Gore-Tex is Teflon.
Okay, so it's Teflon.
But even with polyethylene, they'll actually get a readout of something called the melt index. And that's a measure of how thick it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, the melt index is this, that's the material I want. But the melt index can be, you know, a highly branched system that's low molecular weight or a high molecular weight system that's not highly branched. And they don't really know. We're presuming lots of this. We measure pressure and temperature, and we have some model, some idea of how it works to figure out, is this thick enough to be blown into a film or not?
So the end result, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all fine and good until you have a disturbance, right?
Yes.
And that's the whole problem.
And that is a big problem
in
that industry.
How do you correct for it then?
Yeah.
Or how do you even know you had a disturbance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the end result that you want, that the, you know, dude or dudette on the street wants, is a raincoat that doesn't soak up water when they get it. But temperature, viscosity, these other kind of things aren't obviously directly related to the end product characteristics. So this is Martha's research area.
But I mean, we actually do know that the final, say, hydrophobicity of the material that you're making, it's really sensitive to temperature. You know, it's not that we think the temperature that you make it at, say, it's not that we can't affect it. It's just, we can't actually measure it when we're making it. We know we can act on it.
Right. That's kind of what I was trying to get the point out to people was that you're not necessarily measuring the end product attribute that you want. You've got to know enough about the material science and everything and the chemistry to know what you need to measure to get the end result.
But it could be in this case you have some sort of disturbance. So say Dylan flushes the toilet in the chemical plant. So so the temperature changes as a result of that. And that's going to change the molecular weight. That's going to change the hydrophobicity.
Exactly.
Right. So the observability, what that helps you do, those tools help you do, is to say, well, since the temperature changed this much, then the molecular weight would have changed this much through my model. And therefore, through another model, the hydrophobicity would change by this
amount. Just to the general public, I was trying to get, you don't necessarily measure the thing that's the ideal goal at the end.
Right.
You're
it's
measuring
nice
other
you
stuff leading up to that final thing.
And it's not. It's always better if you can measure what it is that you care about.
A lot of times
it's
you can't.
Better. But well, that's what happens when you can't. What can you do?
If you can't, is that an application of this model predictive control where you use a model to understand?
Should we explain what a model
is? Actually, we should right after this break where we'll take a quick pause. Bill's going to ingest some more caffeine. You're listening to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta.
Work can be fun, but it isn't fun if you get hurt on the job. Wear the proper safety equipment. When you're working outside, drink plenty of water, and don't be afraid to ask for help from your coworkers. Remember, your boss is responsible for your safety. Know your limits and your rights. Work hard and be safe. For more information, visit OSHA.gov or call 800-321-OSHA.
A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
Disappointed your favorite new music station has gone the way of the VHS? Well, don't you fret. Personality Crisis is still on every Sunday evening from 10 to 12, taking care of your favorite new wave, punk, and alternative music from 1900 till now. We were here when they were playing New Kids on the Block, and we'll still be here when they change formats again, which will probably be next week. That's Personality Crisis. For nearly 24 years now, your new music leader. Sunday evenings at 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Craziest electronic music? Tune in every Wednesday evening here on WREK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the movies.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun. From industrial to IDM, from noisecore to bitrock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
We feature in-studio sets, live interviews, and recorded mixes from the finest of local, national, and international electronic music.
Focus on everything from labels such as Warp, Schematic, Merc, and all sorts of man labels to suit your synth fancy.
That's every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. All your electronic music needs, the Mobius here on WREK.
The home of true quality diverse music.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. So, Bill, where are we going now? You've had enough caffeine now. You've ingested some caffeine?
I think I have.
You're ready to go.
Model. So, what is a model?
Oh, you wanted me to answer?
I can answer. Okay. Model is you write a bunch of equations, algebraic, otherwise calculus, that describe what's going on with the system. So you do know when you increase the viscosity that the expected outcome of that, if you increase it a certain amount, is going to be a certain quality about the end material for a Gore-Tex raincoat, for example. So that's the model. So you get it in math, so you can do it on a computer.
And once you get it in math, then that's kind of when the control theory can tell you something. Once you have these equations, then you can take some other control theory equations, and it'll tell you, for example, whether or not you can observe the system or not.
Right. And so the other, so feedback is something that you see. So what is feedback?
So the idea in feedback is very central to control. And the idea in feedback is that you measure something, and then you use that to make the decision about something, to act back on the system that you originally measured. So it's really like going around in a loop. And then once you act on the system, now the system changes, now you measure it again, and now you act on it again, and you keep going around and around in a circle. And so it's really a loop, a feedback loop.
And so a kind of a misnomer in the public is people would think that positive feedback is good, negative feedback is bad.
Yeah, that's an excellent example.
So what's the difference between I know the difference between positive and negative feedback, you know, in critiques. What's the difference in control?
So in control, usually what you want is negative feedback. And the reason is, if you measure something and you're going too fast, what do you need to do? Well, you need to slow down, right? So you need to take where you are and then act in the opposite direction. So you take what you measure, you sort of throw a negative sign in front of it, and that determines then which direction you act in. So that's the negative part. If you do positive feedback, you say, I'm going too fast, maybe I should go even faster. And then you go even faster, and you measure, and I'm going even faster, so I'm going to go even faster, and then you just keep going faster and faster and faster and faster.
So
it's terrible. It's unstable.
So your cruise control is negative feedback.
That's right.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Negative is good.
Right. So, yeah, people say, oh, positive. I want positive feedback. Well, you want positive, you know, with regard to yourself.
Maybe then your ego just gets completely out of control.
A little
negative feedback goes a long way.
That might happen with me or Pete. I'm not really sure.
That's never happened in academics before.
Not to academics. But you know, you kind of, I'll say with my kids, you know, it's good to have a lot of positive feedback about what they're doing, a little bit of negative feedback, but an excessive amount of either one's not good.
Everything in moderation.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So how about these laws that Martha talked about, ways that you make your decisions? And despite the fact that you can use a complicated model that predicts, you know, the properties of polyethylene based on temperature, and, you know, temperature relates to how much is reacting because it gives off heat, those are very complicated. And I'll tell you right now, they aren't very good at handling disturbances because it is a complex relationship. A lot of control is done by some simple principles like proportional, integral, differential control, PID control, right?
So we probably like to think everyone's heard that term. Maybe not.
They haven't heard PID control, no.
That's why we're a little out of touch. Maybe just me.
I used to have a cat named Pud, but that's P-U-D, but go ahead.
Okay. So what is PID?
We like our acronyms here.
What is PID control? Everyone does, so that's okay.
It's a three-letter acronym.
Okay.
TLA.
What does it mean?
So it stands for proportional, integral, and derivative. But the place to start is really with the P. So what happens in a proportional controller is that you compute the error. So the error is, mathematically, the difference between where you are, based on your measurement, and where you want to be. So that's your error. And so what a proportional controller does is it takes that amount, your error, it multiplies it by some number, some constant number, proportionality constant. It puts a negative sign in front of that for the negative feedback, and that's your new action. That's a proportional controller. And so it's pretty logical, I think, which is a good thing in a controller or in life in general. So that's really the basis for how a controller works.
Okay.
Now, you can do some fancy stuff with your I and your D and improve it, but basically, you want to just measure your error and then act in the other direction.
The idea that you're driving that error to zero.
Right.
Yeah, you'd like to drive the error to zero. What happens with a proportional controller, though, is actually the error doesn't go to zero. It starts going down until the error gets small enough that it balances another term, through your model, and then it kind of stops. So that's really the problem with a proportional controller is it doesn't actually drive the error to zero, which is what you'd like to do.
So you always have what control people call an offset. It's offset by a little amount. And if that's small, no, that's okay.
Well, and the way that you make it small, actually, is you crank up this proportionality constant. Mm-hmm. So now this is the idea of the aggressive controller that I was talking about with the shower example. If you act too much, it actually doesn't work out very well either. So if you make a real aggressive controller with a high gain, it will drive the steady state error to zero, but then it can cause you to overreact, and that can be bad too.
Okay, so the gain on a controller is more or less that proportionality constant.
That's exactly right. The gain is the proportionality constant.
All right, I got one thing right today.
That's more than one thing, right? We'll have to break down and listen to the tape.
I always figure I can go home once I've learned one thing.
So. We'll have to.
All right, let's wrap it then. Okay, and then, so if we think about the other ones, I mean, when I think of proportional, I think of I'm driving down the road, and if I drift from a little bit out of my lane, I'll sort of correct back proportional to the degree that I've done that. And then there's the old guy syndrome, where you realize you've drifted onto the shoulder, and you've been doing that for 20 miles, and you're so embarrassed that you quickly make a correction back because you think people lump you in with the people that leave their turn signal on for, you know, 35 mm-hmm. minutes. That's kind of the integral part, right? Where you add up the effect over time.
That's right. So if it turns out that you have, you've been a little bit off for a long period of time,
right.
in an integral controller, that'll cause you to make a big action, even though you've only been a little bit off at each point in time.
Right.
If you're always off in the same direction.
Right.
Yeah. So that helps you get rid of that steady state error. So then you
can
have
I bring
a PI.
Up Kalman filters?
No, let me do derivative control first. So derivative control, the derivative is the rate at which you're deviating, right? Is that a correct statement?
That's right.
Okay.
It's the rate of change of the error.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Say, for example, you get a flat tire and you have a small change, but it's very, very rapid. Suddenly your car jerks. I mean, if you've ever gotten a flat tire at 60 miles an hour, your car jerks 2 feet to the right very, very quickly. Then your response is response to the derivative. You'll try to control that, keep from slamming the guy next to you.
So I usually view the derivative term as it's a little extra you can add to improve your performance kind of in the end. It's not the major source that you would want. Mm-hmm. Another problem with derivative is if your measurement's a little bit noisy, then the derivative really doesn't work well at all. Because you think the system's changing, but it's not real change. It's just from your measurement. So you have to be careful with derivative. So you might add a little bit on.
All right. Now, you wanted to bring up something about filters, Bill?
Kalman filter. So what is a Kalman filter?
Well, a Kalman filter is actually back to the observability sensor question. So a Kalman filter is one of these equations, control equations, that you can use to answer a question for you. And the question there would be, here are my measure variables, and what's the true state of the system? And so that's actually kind of a separate piece then from the control law. So before you can figure out what your error is, or before you can compute it, you have to figure out what it is. If you're not measuring the error, then you may need to use a Kalman filter first to come up with estimates of the state.
And it also, you're kind of holding back on the technology not to confuse people, but one of the advances for that was to include the kind of noise, the nature of the noise, measurement noise. So if you know what that measurement noise is, it's great. But I you know, from personal experience, if you're wrong about what you've assumed about the noise and the error covariance and that kind of thing, you're worse off than assuming nothing at all.
As with many computer issues, it's sort of a garbage in, garbage out sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you can say, I'm going to come up with this fancier control algorithm, and I have to, you know, come up with this really complicated model and estimates of uncertainty, and it'll work really well as long as you are actually right about what you assumed about your model and about your noise sources. So to the extent that those are wrong, then that's going to lead to problems with the controller. So sometimes simpler is better.
So, for example, this over in this past winter, I was driving and hit. I was only going like 20 miles an hour, so surface Gore-Tex, I mean, you want it to not soak up water.
Well, let's just take polyethylene, right? When you make polyethylene, the readouts on your controllers for big companies that do this, they look at the pressure of the ethylene, and they look at the temperature and the heat output. And
now, is
that
what Gore-Tex is? Or?
No, that's polytetrafluoroethylene. It's Teflon.
Okay.
Gore-Tex is Teflon.
Okay, so it's Teflon. You're
making
Teflon.
But even with polyethylene, they'll actually get a readout of something called the melt index, and that's a measure of how thick it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, the melt index is this, that's the material I want, but the melt index can be, you know, a highly branched system that's low molecular weight or a high molecular weight system that's not highly branched. And they don't really know. We're presuming lots of this. We measure pressure and temperature, and we have some model, some idea of how it works to figure out, is this thick enough to be blown into a film or not?
So the end result, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all fine and good until you have a disturbance, right?
Yes.
And that's the whole problem.
And that is a big problem.
How
in
do
that
you correct
industry.
For it then?
Yeah.
Or how do you even know you had a disturbance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the end result that you want, that the, you know, dude or dudette on the street wants, is a raincoat that doesn't soak up water when they get it. But temperature, viscosity, these other kind of things, aren't obviously directly related to the end product characteristics. So this is Martha's research area.
But I mean, we actually do know that the final, say, hydrophobicity of the material that you're making, it's really sensitive to temperature. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that we think the temperature that you make it at, say, it's not that we can't affect it. It's just we can't actually measure it when we're making it. We know we can act on it.
Right. Kind of what I was trying to get the point out to people was that you're not necessarily measuring the end product attribute that you want. You've got to know enough about the material science and everything and the chemistry to know what you need to measure to get the end result.
But it could be in this case you have some sort of disturbance. So say Dylan flushes the toilet in the chemical plant. So the temperature changes as a result of that. And that's going to change the molecular weight. That's going to change the hydrophobicity.
Exactly.
You know? So the observability, what that helps you do, those tools help you do, is to say, well, since the temperature changed this much, then the molecular weight would have changed this much through my model. And therefore, through another model, the hydrophobicity would change by this
amount. Right, so just to the general public, I was trying to get, you don't necessarily measure the thing that's the ideal goal at the end.
Right.
You're measuring other stuff leading up to that final thing.
And it's always better if you can measure what it is that you care about.
A lot of times you can't.
Better. But that's what happens when you can't. What can you do?
If you can't, is that an application of this model predictive control where you use a model to understand?
Should we explain what a model is?
Actually, you should right after this break where we'll take a quick pause. Bill's going to ingest some more caffeine. You're listening to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta.
Work can be fun, but it isn't fun if you get hurt on the job. Wear the proper safety equipment. When you're working outside, drink plenty of water, and don't be afraid to ask for help from your coworkers. Remember, your boss is responsible for your safety. Know your limits and your rights. Work hard and be safe. For more information, visit OSHA.gov or call 800-321-OSHA.
A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
Disappointed your favorite new music station has gone the way of the VHS? Well, don't you fret. Personality Crisis is still on every Sunday evening from 10 to 12, taking care of your favorite new wave, punk, and alternative music from 1900 till now. We were here when they were playing New Kids on the Block, and we'll still be here when they change formats again, which will probably be next week. That's Personality Crisis. For nearly 24 years now, your new music leader. Sunday evenings at 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Best and craziest electronic music, tune in every Wednesday evening here on WREK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the Mobius.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun, from industrial to IDM, from noise core to bit rock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
We feature in-studio sets, live interviews, and recorded mixes from the finest in local, national, and international electronic music.
Focus on everything from labels such as Warp, Schematic, Merc, and all sorts of net labels to suit your synth fancy.
With every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. All your electronic music needs, the Mobius here on WREK.
The home of true quality diverse music.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. So, Bill, where are we going now? You've had enough caffeine now. You've ingested some caffeine?
I think I have.
You're ready to go.
Model. So, what is a model?
Oh, you wanted me to answer?
Or I can answer. Okay. Model is you write a bunch of equations, algebraic, otherwise calculus, that describe what's going on with the system. So you do know when you increase the viscosity that the expected outcome of that, if you increase it a certain amount, is going to be a certain quality about the end material for a Gore-Tex raincoat, for example. So that's the model So you get it in math, so you can do right. it on a computer.
And once you get it in math, then that's kind of when the control theory can mm-hmm. can tell you something.
Right. Okay.
Once you have these equations, then you can take some other control theory equations, and it'll tell you, for example, whether or not you can observe the system or not.
Right. And so the other, so feedback is something that you see. So what is feedback?
So the idea in feedback is very central to control. And the idea in feedback is that you measure something, and then you use that to make the decision about something, to act back on the system that you originally measured. So it's really like going around in a loop. And then once you act on the system, now the system changes, now you measure it again, and now you act on it again, and you keep going around and around in a circle. And so it's really a loop, a feedback loop.
And so a kind of a misnomer in the public is people would think that positive feedback is good, negative feedback is bad.
Yeah, that's an excellent example.
So what's the difference between I know the difference between positive and negative feedback, you know, in critiques. What's the difference in control?
So in control, usually what you want is negative feedback. And the reason is, if you measure something and you're going too fast, what do you need to do? Well, you need to slow down, right? So you need to take where you are and then act in the opposite direction. So you take what you measure, you sort of throw a negative sign in front of it, and that determines then which direction you act in. So that's the negative part. If you do positive feedback, you say, I'm going too fast, maybe I should go even faster. And then you go even faster, and you measure, and I'm going even faster, so I'm going to go even faster, and then you just keep going faster and faster and faster and faster.
So
it's terrible. It's unstable.
So your cruise control is negative feedback.
That's right.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Negative is good.
Right. So, yeah, people say, oh, positive. I want positive feedback. Well, you want positive, you know, with regard to yourself.
Maybe then your ego just gets completely out of control.
Negative
feedback goes a long way.
That might happen with me or Pete. I'm not really sure.
That's never happened in academics.
No, not to academics. But you know, you kind of, I'll say with my kids, you know, it's good to have a lot of positive feedback about what they're doing, a little bit of negative feedback, but an excessive amount of either one's not good.
Everything in moderation.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So how about these laws that Martha talked about, ways that you make your decisions? And despite the fact that you can use a complicated model that predicts, you know, the properties of polyethylene based on temperature, and, you know, temperature relates to how much is reacting because it gives off heat, those are very complicated. And I'll tell you right now, they aren't very good at handling disturbances because it is a complex relationship. A lot of control is done by some simple principles like proportional, integral, differential control, PID control, right?
So we probably like to think everyone's heard that term. Maybe not.
They haven't heard PID control, no.
That's why we're a little out of touch. Maybe just me.
I used to have a cat named Pud, but that's P-U-D, but go ahead.
Okay. So what is PID?
We like our acronyms here.
What is PID control? Everyone does, so that's okay.
It's a three-letter acronym.
Okay.
TLA.
What does it mean?
So it stands for proportional, integral, and derivative. But the place to start is really with the P. So what happens in a proportional controller is that you compute the error. So the error is, mathematically, the difference between where you are, based on your measurement, and where you want to be. So that's your error. And so what a proportional controller does is it takes that amount, your error, it multiplies it by some number, some constant number, proportionality constant. It puts a negative sign in front of that for the negative feedback, and that's your new action. That's a proportional controller. And so it's pretty logical, I think, which is a good thing in a controller or in life in general. So that's really the basis for how a controller works.
Okay.
Now, you can do some fancy stuff with your I and your D and improve it. But basically, you want to just measure your error and then act in the other direction.
Proportional to that. With the idea that you're driving that error to zero.
Right.
Yeah, you'd like to drive the error to zero. What happens with a proportional controller, though, is actually the error doesn't go to zero. It starts going down until the error gets small enough that it balances another term through your model, and then it kind of stops. So that's really the problem with a proportional controller, is it doesn't actually drive the error to zero, which is what you'd like to do.
So you always have what control people call an offset. It's offset by a little amount. And if that's small, No, it's okay.
Well, and the way that you make it small, actually, is you crank up this proportionality constant. Mm-hmm. So now this is the idea of the aggressive controller that I was talking about with the shower example. If you act too much, it actually doesn't work out very well either. So if you make a real aggressive controller with a high gain, it will drive the steady state error to zero. But then it can cause you to overreact, and that can be bad too.
Okay, so the gain on a controller is more or less that proportionality constant.
That's exactly right. The gain is the proportionality constant.
All right. I got one thing right today. That's
you got more than one thing, right? We'll have to break down and listen to the tape.
I always figure I can go home once I've learned one thing.
So. We'll have to.
All right, let's wrap it then. Okay, and then, so if we think about the other ones, I mean, when I think of proportional, I think of I'm driving down the road, and if I drift from a little bit out of my lane, I'll sort of correct back proportional to the degree that I've done that. And then there's the old guy syndrome, where you realize you've drifted onto the shoulder, and you've been doing that for 20 miles, and you're so embarrassed that you quickly make a correction back because you think people lump you in with the people that leave their turn signal on for, you know, 35 mm-hmm. minutes. That's kind of the integral part, right? Where you add up the effect over time.
That's right. So if it turns out that you have, you've been a little bit off for a long period of time,
right,
in an integral controller, that'll cause you to make a big action, even though you've only been a little bit off at each point in time.
Right.
If you're always off in the same direction.
Right.
Yeah. So that helps you get rid of that steady state error. So then you have a
PI. Can I bring up Kalman filters?
No, let me do derivative control first. So derivative control, the derivative is the rate at which you're deviating, right? Is that a correct statement?
That's right.
Okay.
It's the rate of change of the error.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Say, for example, you get a flat tire and you have a small change, but it's very, very rapid. Suddenly your car jerks. I mean, if you ever gotten a flat tire at 60 miles an hour, your car jerks 2 feet to the right very, very quickly. Then your response is response to the derivative. You'll try to control that, keep from slamming the guy next to you.
So I usually view the derivative term as it's a little extra you can add to improve your performance kind of in the end. It's not the major source that you would want. Mm-hmm. Another problem with derivative is if your measurement's a little bit noisy, then the derivative really doesn't work well at all. Because you think the system's changing, but it's not real change. It's just from your measurement. So you have to be careful with derivative. So you might add a little bit on.
All right. Now, you wanted to bring up something about filters, Bill?
Kalman filter. So what is a Kalman filter?
Well, a Kalman filter is actually back to the observability sensor question. So a Kalman filter is one of these equations, control equations, that you can use to answer a question for you. And the question there would be, here are my measure variables, and what's the true state of the system? That's actually kind of a separate piece then from the control law. So before you can figure out what your error is, or before you can compute it, you have to figure out what it is. If you're not measuring the error, then you may need to use a Kalman filter first to come up with estimates of the state.
And also, you're kind of holding back on the technology, not to confuse people, but one of the advances for that was to include the kind of noise, the nature of the noise, measurement noise. So if you know what that measurement noise is, it's great. But I you know, from personal experience, if you're wrong about what you've assumed about the noise and the error covariance and that kind of thing, you're worse off than assuming nothing at all.
As with many computer issues, it's sort of a garbage in, garbage out sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you can say, I'm going to come up with this fancier control algorithm, and I have to, you know, come up with this really complicated model and estimates of uncertainty, and it'll work really well as long as you are actually right about what you assumed,
right,
about your model and about your noise sources. So to the extent that those are wrong, then that's going to lead to problems with the controller. So sometimes simpler is better.
So, for example, this past winter, I was driving and hit, I was only going like 20 miles an hour, so it was surface street. I hit a patch of ice, but it wasn't even the length of the car. It was about half the length of the car, and the anti-lock brake system kicked in, and I continued to swerve for about 50 yards after that because the anti-lock brake system had kicked in because of that little... So it saw the ice, you know, or felt, sensed that I was on ice and losing traction. So that's a case where it was assuming that if that's happening, it's a long range. I'm in a lot of ice, not down in Atlanta where I've got a little tiny pocket of ice.
Well, that's why they just close everything down here when there's any threat of snow.
Because I'm going to be on the road.
Pretty much.
Right. So one other issue is, do we need to take a quick break here?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, so I want to talk about stability when we come back. And just a reminder to our listening audience, this is a live show, despite the fact we may have put some of you to sleep. You can give us a call. What's the number again, Trent?
404-894-2468.
If you've got a question for Martha about this riveting topic of control theory, we'll be right back after this break.
It is riveting.
Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Of the 1.3 billion people living in absolute poverty, 70% of them are women. Why care?
I've learned better farming techniques and have been able to grow more potatoes than my family needs. Selling them at the local market has allowed me to send my children to school.
Why care?
I am powerful.
She has the power to change her world. You have the power to help her do it. Visit care.org.
Tune in every Tuesday night to Live at Rec, where we bring a live local band to play a concert for you in the Georgia Tech Student Center, and here on 91.1 FM WREK Atlanta.
Are you in the mood for Latin rock?
Latin lounge and fusion?
And Latin sports, like soccer and more soccer.
Then tune in Hemisferios.
Every Monday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m.
With your host, Angelo Temponi,
Gabriel Serhai,
and Andres Hernandez.
On WREK.
Atlanta.
91.1 FM.
We are back.
All right, we're back where we're talking about stability. Stability is something that Martha mentioned earlier, in that you want this negative feedback control because that's stable. But there are plenty of examples, unlike, you know, typical PID controllers, or the one most people are familiar with, when James Watt on the steam engine put the two-ball governor, right? There's these rotating two balls, and as they went higher and higher and higher, they would give you the negative feedback because it would take more and more angular momentum to spin them. And that's a mechanical example of it. But there are examples where things are unstable, and that's modern fighter aircraft, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think we should probably define stability first.
Yes, that's good.
Yeah. So it means, again, what you think it should mean. If something stays where it is, it doesn't move, or if it always kind of tends to move a little bit and then it moves back again, and it doesn't really go anywhere, that's stable. If the opposite is true, you move it a little bit and it just flies off, really does something crazy, then that would be unstable, so like fly off the handle. You know?
Right, so hence the characterization of Bill and I as mentally unstable.
Yeah, so this is all consistent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people, you know, if you can kind of predict what someone's going to do because they don't really move very far away from their comfort zone, then they're probably pretty stable, right?
Okay.
So if they just do crazy stuff, you never can't predict what's going on, then you could classify that as unstable.
Right.
So that's the same idea here. Now, there are also, you can think about the stability of your original system before you try to control it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can think about the stability of the whole system once you put the controller around it. So the notion of stability is relevant for both of those. It still means the same thing, but you might have an initially unstable system and you put a controller on it and then you make it stable. So that's an example of what you want a controller to do.
So is the notion, so there's, having a flashback from studying for the PhD exam at Illinois, the controllability and observability. So observability is one issue. Controllability is another. In other words, have you got the right kind of feedback in there to control it?
Yeah, that's right. So if you put a controller on and it's still unstable, it's probably not going to be controllable. So all controllability means is that you can drive the system to where you want it to go.
So fighter aircraft may be inherently unstable, but they are controllable because obviously we couldn't fly them. if they weren't controllable via the control schemes
that's
that
right.
are built
that's
in.
Right.
But there's
well,
a trade-off,
aren't always,
right?
It's not always a yes or no question. So you can make it do some things that you want it to do. It might not be fully controllable. You might not be able to make that aircraft do every possible thing you could imagine. But, you know, we don't always expect that in engineered systems. So controllability is kind of a yes or no test, but a lot of the time, a system's kind of partially controllable.
So but there is a trade-off, though, right? If something is very, very stable, it doesn't necessarily have the attributes that a potentially sometimes unstable fighter aircraft has, right?
Exactly. So instability can be good. So it's not always, you don't always want
there
something
go,
to be
Bill.
Very stable.
We're not
so,
so
remember
bad.
That. Because
I'm telling my
stable's
wife that
boring,
tonight.
You know? And,
yes,
and you want
there
it to be
go.
Able to do stuff, right?
Right.
So, yeah, that's right. It's a fine line. But if you have a big old cargo aircraft, it can't have the same performance as a fighter aircraft, no matter what controller you put on it.
Right. So it
it's
can't
just not
zip to the right very quickly like you'd want
so,
something
yeah,
to do.
So
yeah.
Are these systems that are kind of at the razor edge between stable and unstable, are those good for certain applications and not good for others?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is an argument that that I make a lot of times in my own research program is we have processes to make materials and they'll work and they'll be very stable. But we might be able to make the materials cheaper or better or both if we had a system that was a little bit more unstable. But in order to make that work, we'd probably need some control because there'll always be disturbances. So if you put more control into the system, then you can potentially get a much higher performance.
Now, I mean, one of the things in the semiconductor industry that's always been fascinating, the history of it, was that some things they found they just couldn't control. So you had from the vacuum tube, you know, one vacuum tube to the other, it's all very, very consistent, but you can't control the gain of a transistor, for example, so they just came up with topologies where it didn't matter.
Yeah, that's right. So there are a couple of things you can do. You can put a controller on something to correct for uncertainty or variability. Mm-hmm. Another thing you can do is come up with an overall system design where the variability doesn't really matter.
Right.
And
right.
But that can also lead to worse performance. So, for example, you might have redundancy to account for variability. So mm-hmm. you might say some of my transistors fail, but I'll have extra ones, and I can wire it so
right.
to account for that. But,
right.
you know, that costs more. Right. So there's always a cost.
So we had a question from a listener a little
yes.
while ago, and what was that, Trent? I mean,
jobs.
Where do you learn about control?
And where do you go?
Where do you work? I guess who gets the patents?
What are some industries
well,
that
actually,
use it?
Here's a quote from the department chair of the Automatic Control and Systems Department at the University of Sheffield in the UK, where they point out that systems and control is in everyday use, basically that it's everywhere, in cars, aircraft, marine systems. And we were pointing out at the break that every major engineering discipline has a control field. Is that
right.
correct?
Well, pretty much. So one actually that doesn't is material science and engineering. And that's kind of a hybrid between science and engineering. And so I think there's a future for control there, which is
and that's where you work, coincidentally.
Yeah, it is. But it's not. But most of the engineering disciplines do have control.
Right. And many chemical engineers make materials, and they would agree that control is important in those processes.
So how would you guys feel about courses, say at Georgia Tech, being taught in controls and having the students from all disciplines take the same course?
Well, actually, that does happen some. So my students in chemical and biomolecular engineering, my graduate students, take electrical engineering courses. So electrical engineering is just such a big department, and they offer a lot more graduate courses in control. So my students take courses over there. So there's some crossover. I did my graduate work at Caltech, and Caltech's kind of unusual in that they have a separate department called Control and Dynamical Systems. And so that allows people from all the other different applications, aerospace, mechanical, electrical, chemical, to all kind of come together and work on control theory together with a lot of different applications. But it's not usually the traditional way that it's taught.
Right, and obviously University of Sheffield and other places have those things, but most of
actually,
them...
that's a European model, having the control department. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So in the U.S., okay. it's just not
I
so common.
I did not know that. Mm-hmm.
So I was just thinking, if you're a junior taking or a senior taking a controls course and you're in electrical engineering, if you had a professor who's in mechanical, you know, you might have a little bit more to learn in the... you know, the background and the terminology, but you'd sort of see a wider use for what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. I think right now, my experience has been there's not a lot of cross-fertilization at the undergraduate level, and mm-hmm. that there are some of us who are maybe interested in seeing more of that. But mm-hmm. right now, there okay. really isn't a lot of that. But I think okay. there's a potential benefit for doing that.
And jobs. jobs.
Right. So, I mean, and you also want to point that in industrial and systems engineering as well as even mathematics, there are people that work on control issues as well. So the jobs are everywhere that an electrical, an industrial, a chemical, a material science.
So what industries?
Aerospace industry is a big one. Yeah. Aircraft. Another one is in chemical processing.
Right, chemical processing, petrochemical, paper making, for example.
Yeah.
Right. And then there are people that just work for control companies, like
Johnson
Honeywell or Johnson Controls, that just control things.
And then they work with other companies and sell the controllers to other companies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But is that an issue? It sounds as though there should be more cross-fertilization, because when you go in to control something at a paper company, you know, there are lots of issues where you may not understand what is and isn't a measurable variable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you say, well, just measure, you know, this, and they laugh at you because they realize no one can really measure that.
Well, there's something to be said also for coming up with tools that are customized for the particular application.
Right.
So there's always a balance there, that there are reasons that there are some control tools that are used in chemical engineering, others that are used more in aerospace. I think one interesting thing is that as computers have gotten faster, there are control ideas that have been done for a long time in chemical processing. This model predictive control that Pete mentioned is something that's been used for a long time in chemical processing, but it takes a lot of computation. But a chemical plant's really slow. So you have a lot of time to compute what you should do next before you actually have to do it, because it doesn't respond over hours or days or something.
Right.
Now, if you have a fighter aircraft, it responds really quickly, so you don't have as much time to compute. But now that computers are getting faster, people are starting to use ideas like model predictive control in aerospace.
So faster computers are driving the application of more advanced control systems.
Yeah, or it's making possible techniques in one area that used to only be possible in another area.
Well,
yeah, so cross-fertilization is good then, if we can learn from each other and the disciplines are changing.
All right, so we're rounding out. We've just got a few minutes left. The question is, what have we learned? Well, first thing, I should point out that hopefully we've learned that Bill's example isn't the greatest one. Nobody makes a raincoat out of Gore-Tex. It's just too expensive.
Don't?
They just use butyl rubberized fabric. That would be cool.
Did they call it Gore-Tex and it wasn't really Gore-Tex? No, they lied to me.
Insulation. I think they did lie to you.
They lied to me.
I believe they did.
You might have insulation. Do you really have a Gore-Tex raincoat?
Not anymore.
Oh.
It was stolen.
Okay, and I guess another thing is that control is really everywhere. We didn't really talk about that, but every household appliance you have, it might be a simple proportional controller, or even like your thermostat, a binary controller, where it switches the HVAC on or off, depending on the thermostat, but almost everything is controlled. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, what is it? Negative feedback is good in control.
Right.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Blows your mind.
It does blow my mind.
Right.
There you have it.
Right.
All right. Anything else that we want to add? Anything you need to add, Trent?
Nothing.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for joining us here on Inside the Black Box. And hopefully we'll talk to you next week here on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier on WREK Atlanta.